Today is January the 26th, 2022. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Network. www.prn.live, that's L-I-V-E, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Microsoft releases Woke Spell Checker. Tech giant Microsoft has added an additional feature which reads through a user's work and examines whether the language used may offend an individual. The new spell check function has been rolled out across the latest version of Microsoft Word in Office 365, which users access via a yearly subscription. The new spell checker puts a purple line beneath any text deemed problematic. The software also offers the user some PC alternatives to the flagged phrases. It is included on the new versions of Word accessed via Office 365 since 2019. Users can enable or disable the function in Word's editor by clicking on Settings. After highlighting the inclusivity issue, Word's new functionality will suggest more acceptable alternatives, such as which includes discarding blacklist and whitelist in favor of accepted list or allowed list. Microsoft has released a statement in which it recognized that the inclusivity spell checker may not be suitable for all scenarios and stressed that users can choose to turn the checker off at any point to be in control of their final output. In the section labeled Proofreading, navigate to a second settings button located next to the Grammar and Refinement section. Users can then check or uncheck the boxes under the heading Inclusiveness to enable or disable the spell checker. Users who do not want to use the inclusivity filter can uncheck the boxes before clicking OK. When all the boxes are checked, the software will screen text which is perceived to involve any of the following: age bias, cultural bias, ethnic slurs, gender bias, gender-neutral pronouns, gender-specific language, racial bias, sexual orientation bias, and socioeconomic bias. Microsoft has released a statement on the application of inclusivity in the spell checker. Microsoft understands that not every editor suggestion may be suitable for all users and or scenarios. That is why we let users be in control of their final output. Editor is a completely optional tool that users can turn on or turn off at any point. Editor does not make any auto corrections. The user has control over which suggestions they choose to use, if any. They will be able to turn on and off each one of them individually. Microsoft's push to make its users more politically correct has drawn criticism in recent months. If the Senate is going to address the monopoly role that big tech plays in controlling information dissemination, then it certainly should include the company that dominates the workplace software productivity market. This becomes even more acutely clear as Microsoft has put the tool in place to force-feed political correctness onto every blank page through their politically correct language tool. A tool that is both frightening and dangerous that can be turned on during the next update without a user's knowledge. The IRS will require taxpayers to sign up with ID.me. Starting this summer, taxpayers wanting to access their online accounts on IRS.gov will soon be required to take a selfie and verify their identity with ID.me. Existing online accounts with IRS.gov, which require only an email and password to access, will no longer work as of the middle of 2022. The IRS says the move is necessary to protect taxpayers from potential identity theft, but privacy advocates says it is invasive and point out that the company behind ID.me has a spotty record in verifying people's identities. The move will only lead to further ruin for Americans when their data is inevitably breached. ID.me, a 12-year-old company that started as a way for military veterans to get discounts, has boomed during the pandemic, becoming the government's default ID verification system. The company has pulled in over $200 million in venture funding and secured contracts with 27 states as they try to root out fraud in the unemployment system, for instance. It's valued at $1.5 billion. A spokesperson for the IRS said that Americans would not need to take a selfie or make an ID.me account in order to file their tax return, and they called this notion wildly inaccurate as it had been reported by other media. The IRS emphasizes taxpayers can pay without submitting a selfie or other information to a third-party identity verification company. Tax payments can be made from a bank account, by credit card, or by means without the use of facial recognition technology or registering for an account, the agency said. However, taxpayers will need to register with a new security system to see records of previous payments, access their wage transcripts, or to access their child tax credit update portal. Additional IRS tools will transition to use ID.me verification over the next year, the agency said. A long verification process. CPAs commonly advise taxpayers to request a transcript from the IRS, which details all income that employers, banks, or online platforms have reported to the agency before filing a return. To sign up for an account, users need to provide an email address and a landline or mobile phone number, upload identity documents, and take a selfie with a camera that will then scan the user's face to verify the identity. If the application flags any issues with a taxpayer's documents, the person will be asked to do a video chat or phone call with an ID.me representative. The user is also required to agree to the use of their biometric data, which ID.me says can include handprints, face scans, facial geometry, and retina scans. A Gizmodo reporter began the process of verifying his identity with ID.me, but stopped when ID.me requested access to his credit report. The IRS has sometimes struggled to protect taxpayers' data, even shutting down its online transcript service back in 2015 after it found that fraudsters were using it to steal identities. Privacy and data theft is significant at the IRS. They are deathly afraid of a hack. The service is trying to modernize and make sure, from a data protection standpoint, they want to make sure that someone who is getting your data is authorized. However, ID.me is not without its problem. The system has been plagued by complaints from frustrated unemployment recipients who said they couldn't get past the verification process, with one California senator blaming it for putting thousands of legitimate claims in limbo. Get ready for free next-gen TV broadcasts. Before cable TV, there was over-the-air TV with a rabbit ear antenna. Now with digital television, well, you can't get that kind of reception with just the antenna in the same place. It is still available, but the number of channels are also limited, and without the multi-channel selection program material available with normal cable TV. Normal cable TV are available today, albeit at ever-increasing subscription costs. And cord-cutting is going on. But we can get back to the future. Get ready for the free next-gen TV broadcasts. It's ATSC 3.0. What is it? ATSC 3.0 is a next-generation terrestrial broadcast system designed from the ground up to improve the television viewing experience with higher audio and video quality, improved compression efficiency, robust transmission for reception on both fixed and mobile devices, and more accessibility, personalization, and interactivity. ATSC 3.0 is also sometimes referred to as next-gen TV. It's built on the same IP backbone as today's popular streaming media platforms. Not only does ATSC 3.0 deliver better video quality and immersive audio to viewers, but it is also easily adaptable for future technologies. The signals are out there, but you also need something to watch them with. Most current TVs won't work with the new broadcasts. The ATSC says that 3 million compatible TVs were sold last year, and the organization estimates that 4.5 million will be sold in 2022, but most are high-end models. LG, Sony, and Samsung have produced compatible TVs in 2020 and 2021, and at this year's CES 2022, Hisense was announced as the fourth official manufacturer, and the biggest holdout today is TCL, whose spokesperson said TCL's TV in the United States use ATSC 1.0 tuners. Meanwhile, a couple more companies are also sell external tuner boxes, which work out cheaper than a whole new television set. Manufacturers are also thinking beyond TVs as well, as there are future plans for including the technology in places such as cars. Sony, by the way, is the only manufacturer to include ATSC 3.0 support across its entire range so far, and the initiative is now in its second year. If you want to watch next-gen TV broadcasts, another option is to get an external tuner, which can connect to any TV. Currently, they're rare, and although a couple OTA DVRs do exist. Silicon Dust released the $199 HD Home Run 4K Flex, which is a DVR with four tuners, two of which are ATSC 3.0. It's a network device, similar to the Amazon Fire TV Recast, that connects to streaming devices on the network and the internet via the HD Home Run app. The only ATSC 3.0 DVR announced for 2022 so far has been the Tablo ATSC 3.0 Quad HDMI. It is available this spring for about $300, and unlike the HD Home Run, it offers full four ATSC 3.0 tuners. The downside is that it's not networkable, and so it's restricted to one TV. At CES, the ATSC organization announced that a low-cost chipset from MediaTek would be available to put into cheaper devices, which could help prices on external tuners come down in the future. There are two main issues with ATSC 3.0 in the United States. The first is the lack of coverage in some of the country's biggest TV markets, including San Francisco, Chicago, and New York City. The second is a lack of content. While the format promises 4K resolutions and features like interactive gambling, these are largely yet to be implemented, because the service is still maturing and depends on support from broadcasters. Most areas still receive only 1080p signals. With budget-friendly devices and more coverage areas on their way, we may find that over the next few years, ATSC 3.0 could finally live up to its cord-cutting potential. Just remember, ATSC 3.0 is over-the-air free. Google illegally used dark patterns in location tracking. What are dark patterns? Dark patterns are tricks used in websites and apps that make you do things that you didn't mean to, like buying or signing up for something. When you use websites and apps, you don't necessarily read every word on every page. You skim read and make assumptions. If a company wants to trick you into doing something, they can take advantage of this by making a page look like it is saying one thing when it is in fact saying another. The website design purposely focuses your attention on one thing in order to distract your attention from another. Ads are disguised as other kinds of content or navigation. There is also forced continuity, such as making it difficult to cancel or unsubscribe. Google illegally used dark patterns to trick users into handing over location data, says state attorney generals. The D.C. and Texas lawsuits allege that deceptive and unfair practices may have violated local laws. On Monday, attorney generals from Washington, D.C., Texas, and at least two other states refocused their sights on Google, claiming the company repeatedly pressures its users to forfeit their location data through dark pattern tactics and other deceptive practices. Altogether, these practices may amount to violations of D.C. Consumer Protection Procedure Act and Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Consumer Protection Act, the lawsuits allege. Washington State and Indiana are expected to file similar suits later, according to the D.C. Attorney General. Though Google does provide its users some options in their settings to limit the types of data they share, the suit argues these are insufficient and leave many uncertain just how much they're giving up to Google. Google leads consumers to believe that consumers are in control of whether Google collects and retains information about their location and how that information is used. The D.C. suit reads, "In reality, consumers who use Google products cannot prevent Google from collecting, storing, and profiting from their location." The D.C. suit, which claims alleged unfair and deceptive practices date back to 2014, argue Google's near ubiquity in the lives of many users through the use of search, maps, docs, phone apps, and other digital staples gives the company an unprecedented ability to monitor consumers' daily lives. Google has a financial incentive to make it difficult for consumers to opt out of being tracked, the suits allege, due to the potential profits gained from digital advertising. For some context, digital advertising, for which location data is extremely valuable, made up nearly 82% of Google's total revenue in the third quarter last year. The upshot is that Google uses its windows into millions of Texans' personal lives to sell targeted advertising designed to exert the maximum influence over those users. In so doing, the company has reaped spectacular gains at the expense of Texans' privacy. Indeed, Google has generated hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, of advertising revenues from ads presented to users in Texas alone. Google did not immediately respond. However, in response to a similar 2020 lawsuit brought by Arizona Attorney General, the company pushed back, claiming the state had mischaracterized its services. Dark patterns, which the suit claims were a crucial part of Google's alleged deceptive practices, refer to the practice of using design tricks like interface design and social engineering that takes advantage of behavioral tendencies to manipulate users into doing something that harms themselves. Lawmakers and regulators in the United States and Europe have criticized dark patterns in the past, with one group of senators even introducing legislation to ban the practice back in 2019. While federal privacy legislation in the United States has remained elusive, states have begun to fill the gap with patchwork privacy solutions. That applies to dark patterns as well. Last year, California approved new regulations under the California Consumer Privacy Act that prohibit dark patterns. Monday's lawsuit drew inspiration from a 2018 Associated Press article that determined Google services were storing user location data even if those users had turned on privacy settings preventing the company from doing so. The D.C. office launched an investigation not long after that article into Google's location tracking practices. In the end, the state determined that regardless of any particular setting a user picked, they had no option but to allow the company to collect, store, and use their location. In an email statement, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, who has led a volley of other suits against Google, went as far as to say the company systemically lies to millions of consumers in order to stack billions of dollars into its coffers. What was the original mission of Google? "Don't be evil," had been Google's unofficial motto since 2000, when it first appeared in the Corporate Code of Conduct. During that time, the phrase was deeply incorporated into Google's company culture. The original model was retained in Google's code of conduct, now a subsidiary of Alphabet. In April 2018, the model was removed from the code of conduct. High radiation levels can cause damage to electronics. That being the case, what might the impact be on the human body for extended space travel missions? Mission planners for the future flights to the Moon, Mars, and beyond rightly worry about how to keep astronauts safe from the hazards of high-energy protons, neutrons, and ions streaming through space. These particles can cause cancer and brain damage, but they can be just as damaging to a spacecraft's electronics. The human body did not evolve to handle life in space, and it shows in our very blood. Since our species first started to spend extended periods of time beyond our planet, researchers have noticed a curious and consistent loss of red blood cells among astronauts. The phenomenon is called space anemia, and until recently, its cause was a mystery. Some experts have argued space anemia is only a short-term phenomenon, a brief compensation for the fluid changes in our bodies under microgravity. A new study, however, points towards a more destructive and lasting mechanism. During a 6-month space mission flight, researchers found that the human body destroys about 54% of more red blood cells than it normally would. The readings are far higher than expected, and they come directly from the breath and blood of 14 astronauts on the International Space Station. These findings are spectacular, considering these measurements have never been made before, and we had no idea if we were going to find anything. The measurements were made via blood tests of iron and breath tests based on carbon monoxide. For every 1 molecule of carbon monoxide exhaled, a molecule of pigment found in the red blood cells is also destroyed, which makes it a useful approximation of red blood cell loss. While still firmly grounded on Earth, astronauts in the study were creating and destroying about 2 million red blood cells a second. During their time in orbit, however, their bodies were destroying roughly 3 million blood cells a second. In microgravity, the human body loses about 10% of the liquid flowing through our blood vessels as blood accumulates in our head and chest. That's why astronauts sometimes look swollen in their videos from the International Space Station. For years, this was an explanation for space anemia. However, the loss of red blood cells was our body's way of compensating for a loss in blood volume. But that's not the current study found. Instead of equalizing the makeup of our blood, the loss of red blood cells appeared to continue unabated throughout spaceflight. Even after 120 days when all red blood cells in an astronaut body has been created in space, the loss of red blood cells continue at a similar pace. The study shows that upon arriving in space, more red blood cells are destroyed, and this continues for the entire duration of the astronaut's mission. When the astronauts were in space, the loss of red blood cells appeared to have led to a higher than normal circulation of iron serum in their blood, without as much red blood cells to transport iron around the body. The astronauts gradually approach anemia, which can be classified into mild, moderate, and severe. When they returned to Earth, 5 out of 13 astronauts, one didn't get blood drawn on landing, had reached clinically diagnosable levels of anemia, defined as a condition where the body doesn't have enough red blood cells for its physiological needs. About 3 or 4 months after landing, their red blood cell levels returned to normal. But even a year after their space flight was done, the astronauts' bodies were still destroying 30% more red blood cells than before their trip to space. The study didn't measure red blood cell production, but given that no astronauts suffer severe anemia, despite the significant losses of red blood cells, their bodies may have also been producing more red blood cells than normal while in space. If that turns out to be true, astronaut diets will need to be adjusted accordingly. An increase in red blood cell production can put added pressure on bone marrow function, and this necessarily requires higher energy consumption. If astronauts are not properly protected, they could risk damage to their heart, lungs, bones, brain, and muscle systems when they return to Earth. Thankfully, having fewer red blood cells in space isn't a problem when your body is weightless. But when landing on Earth and potentially on other planets or moons, anemia affecting your energy, endurance, and strength can threaten mission objectives. The effects of anemia are only felt once you land and must deal with gravity again. The 46th Annual Trenton Computer Festival, TCF 2022, is set for Saturday, March the 19th, 2022. The theme of the festival is Disrupting Climate Change with Technology. It will be held at the College of New Jersey in Trenton, New Jersey. The keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, and he is the co-director of the University Office of Climate Action. He is a climate and sea level scientist and climate policy scholar at Rutgers University's Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences and Rutgers Institute of Earth and Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences. One of the speakers at the festival is Rezwan Razani. She is a writer, planner, game designer, and the founder of Footprint to Wings. She will be giving a talk at the Trenton Computer Festival titled Metrics and Mindset to Disrupt Climate Change, Introducing the First Gigawatt Down, How We Can Use Metaphors and Metrics Together with Databases and User Interfaces and Augmenting Reality and Other Computational Tools and Templates that Can Help Get a Clear Sense of Options to Negotiating Viable Solutions. TCF will be a full day of learning and fun. For more information, you can go to tcf-nj.org. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series. Complaints of IT, Part 4 of 5.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we discuss all of the different relationships and intricacies of information technology in the workplace and how they impact you. And this has been a series. We're talking about the top five complaints for IT departments. We started off with the helpless desk. My kid knows more than you. And why do we have to change our passwords and all of these different lockouts and password problems? I mean, we're not working. You know, this isn't national defense, except actually in one of my companies that I've worked at, it was. So, yeah, this next one is, this is a common thing, and this goes across multiple areas, multiple disciplines within IT. Why is my computer slow? Why is the network slow? Why is my application slow? Why is this slow? And there's so many different reasons. And there's so many different levels of intricacy woven into this overall concept of what is slow, what is fast, what needs to be done, what can be done. And a lot of this works into just the behemoth that we're talking about of information gathering, information processing, and distributing that information in clear, concise formats for management. We have to track. Let's say you sell 1,000 different widgets and you sell roughly 1,000 of each of those widgets every year. Management wants to know which ones are making us money. Management wants to know which ones aren't making us money. Management wants to know where we can streamline things, where we can make more money, where we can do a lot of different things. But to do that, we need all of this information. What happens? Well, yes, that means that there is a certain level of information bloat that occurs as we gather every single little bit of information that we can. Sometimes we go too far in gathering information. Sometimes we don't go far enough. So IT has to decide, okay, what do we ask, what don't we ask? And there's a whole intricacy of details that we have to go through on that one. And I don't want to spend too much time in that direction. But we then move into the next area. So we've got a lot of information that's being processed, and it has to go across that network, and it has to go through your computer, or at least portions of that have to go through your computer. And yes, we are constantly playing a catch-up game. I remember years ago, our networks these days, between your computer and the server, your first link is running at probably one gigabit. I remember computers running on a network at one of the first companies I was in an IT professional for. We were talking about 1.2 megabit. 1.2 megabit. So you've got roughly an understanding here. It's a little bit better than dial-up speeds from way back in the day, but it's not a whole lot. So we've had to adapt along the way. We've had to slowly ramp up the networks throughout. We've had to ramp up the computers. But a lot of this comes with budget. Well, we're going to allow you to spend this much. No. We need three times that much. For us to do all of the things that you've told us we need to do, you need to give us three times the amount of money. Well, you're just a cost center. I've heard that many times. IT is a cost center. Fine. If we're a cost center, do without IT. Sure. Let's see how long the company lasts with that. But that's my cynical side coming up. The issue is, yes, IT is not sitting here and is not intentionally finding ways to slow your computer down. All of us nerds, all of us IT nerds, computer nerds, we actually have a certain level of obsession with trying to get better throughput, trying to get better efficiencies out of computers, out of the network, and finding all of the bottlenecks that are occurring with the application and everything else. But we only have so much time and so much energy to apply all of these different things across not just your computer, not the computer sitting next to you, but for all of the computers throughout the entire company. And some of us don't rise up to the level in management, IT management, to have a distinct, dramatic effect on your computer and technology performance. And that's unfortunate. But there are also other people that are deciding along the layers up through the IT department of where do we focus our energies? Where do we direct all of this IT infrastructure to make us the most effective we can be for this company? And that's the focus. So we have to prioritize. And I don't care if it is one technician that's coming in a matter of 10 hours a week, or if it's a team of 100 technicians working full time, there's a certain level of prioritization, and sometimes speed is good enough. It's not ideal, but we have to work with it. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Chip makers are cutting corners to accelerate semiconductor production. Chip makers are resorting to increasingly desperate measures to keep up with the huge demand of consumers as the semiconductor crunch enters its second year. That includes foregoing quality assurance tests and taking deliveries of equipment weeks in advance. The origins of the shortage, now entering its second year, were spawned in the last half of 2020 when a stimulus-fueled recovery worldwide saw consumers snap up everything. Supply of advanced silicon circuits is inflexible due to the complex manufacturing process involved. It takes years to build new capacity from scratch, making it difficult to meet volatile demands. From start to finish, in building a semiconductor foundry, it takes anywhere from 18 to 36 months. When the United States just recently allocated $52 billion to support semiconductor production, that will not ease the shortage impact until sometime in 2024 at the earliest. Now the world's leading supplier, ASML Holdings, says its clients are starting to take delivery of equipment, foregoing the final steps of quality assurance tests to which they subject exorbitantly priced semiconductor equipment in order to save precious time and money. ASML customers are in bad need of extra capacity, and the bypass of quality assurance tests is unprecedented. Global sales of chips today are booming, according to the Semiconductor Industry Association. Cumulative shipments through the first 11 months of last year reached 1.05 trillion microchips, already marking a new annual record with 1 month of December sales still left to be tabulated. The total value of semiconductors sold across the world, according to SIA estimates, came just shy of breaching the $50 billion mark in the month of November. Even though this already represented a 24% year-on-year increase over November 2020, far more chips are actually needed just to maintain the pace of global growth. Last week, Toyota, one of the few car makers that cope best with a shortage, warned billions of dollars worth of merchandise will not be built as planned after a lack of semiconductors forced it to slash its production plans for February. Building a microchip is far more difficult than just building an automobile. Semiconductors are manufactured in enormous fabrication plants that cost companies billions of dollars in upfront capital and take years to build. At the heart of these foundries are clean rooms that employ miniature circuitry, sometimes only a few atoms in width, onto silicon wafers in a painstaking process requiring weeks to complete. Since a single dust particle can destroy millions of transistors on a wafer, workers wear special equipment suit that covers their whole body to ensure not so much as a hair lands in ASML-sensitive equipment. Temperature and humidity must be kept constant in a clean room, and even the air descends to the floor in a controlled manner where it is repeatedly filtered and recycled. The process is so complex and capital-intensive that entire swaths of the industry decided to go fabless. These chip supplies, such as Advanced Micro Devices, focus on their expertise in chip design and outsource some of it, if not all of their production, to specialist manufacturers called foundries, mainly located in Asia. When consumers ramped up their purchases, these foundries in Asia were overwhelmed. To address the ensuing demands, companies such as Taiwan Semiconductor have been busy bulking up on new equipment. At the top of their list are ASML's latest machines, such as the extreme ultraviolet photolithography systems. ASML is the sole supplier of EUV technology needed to print 5-nanometer transistors like those found in Apple's M1 processor. No other company in the world has proven capable of mastering the complexity of these devices, and the U.S. government has intervened to ban their export to China. Since ASML's equipment can cost up to $340 million each, customers have opted to bypass the final tests in the Netherlands that can last anywhere from 2 weeks to a full month before these machines are packed up and delivered to their final destination. ASML said chipmakers no longer have the patience, desire, or luxury to wait for the entire gamut of tests to be performed. They actually skipped the final testing step. They shipped the system to the customer's site, which actually means there's only one acceptance test. It's all about getting wafers out there. While chip makers may be dependent on Europe for its photolithography machines, Europe is dependent on Asia for its supply of semiconductors, and Taiwan in particular. To mitigate this strategic weakness, the European Commission last week said it would unveil a new CHIPS Act for the 27-member EU bloc in February. Its 5 strategic pillars, including loosening otherwise strict rules around government subsidies, is designed to increase the share of chips manufactured in Europe from 10% to 20% of the world's supply by 2030. Keep in mind that the world's production itself will double by the end of this decade. In order to hike its share of the market amid an already growing market then, this means quadrupling today's European production. Intel buys industry's first next-gen chip-making tool. The company has ordered the first of a new generation of chip-making machines from Dutch specialist ASML. The device, called the TwinScan EXE5200, is scheduled to be delivered in 2024 for operations beginning in 2025. Such machines, each costing $340 million each, are critical to advancing processor progress. Miniaturizing chips is getting steadily harder, but doing so is crucial for tech giants relying on progress in smartphones, PCs, and data centers. Intel for decades led the chip manufacturing industry, steadily shrinking chip circuitry so processors could tackle more and more work. Other companies like GlobalFoundries and IBM fell by the wayside, choosing not to stay on the leading edge of the business. Intel manufacturing problems ceded its lead to Taiwan Semiconductor and Samsung. A core challenge to chip miniaturization is inscribing ever smaller circuitry onto silicon wafers. ASML builds the machine that handles the primary part of this process called photolithography, which literally means writing on stone with light. For this process, Samsung and Taiwan Semiconductor have both made the transition to extreme ultraviolet or EUV, which has a shorter wavelength and therefore can inscribe finer patterns that over many steps become a processor's transistors and wires. Intel was late to adopting EUV lithography, but with an engineer in charge again, Chief Executive Pat Gelsinger is accelerating progress. He said Intel would be the first to order a more advanced EUV tool, which used a high numeric aperture to inscribe even finer features. ASML said last Tuesday it received its first order, and Intel last Wednesday said it was the buyer. However, being the first in line doesn't guarantee success. With so many aspects to chip making, it takes years to bring a new manufacturing process to volume production, and Intel is late learning about the first EUV. Intel expects to start selling its first EUV chips this year and its first high numeric aperture chips in 2025. Processor makers are investing huge sums of money into new foundries prompted by the global chip shortage. Intel plans semiconductor foundry sites in the United States and Europe, each costing about $100 billion, and Taiwan Semiconductor announced it's spending $40 billion to $44 billion this year on new plants. The semiconductor shortage and its consequences. Many pundits think a shortage of semiconductor chips would be short-term. The global semiconductor shortage caused by the pandemic has been occurring for over a year now. The announcements of investments in new foundries will have no immediate impact on relief of the shortages. The delays on these chips have been long, as companies are making efforts to produce their electronics and goods on time. The global supply chain network is completely out of sync. Factories and retailers in Western economies that have largely emerged from lockdowns are eager for finished products. Raw materials and components from long-time supplies in Asia and elsewhere. However, countries in Asia are suffering. They are still experiencing economic hardships due to lockdowns. Confusion is running rampant throughout the world, and it is hitting electronics producers and consumers the most, especially in the United States. The semiconductor industry is a massive one, totaling $464 billion. The loss in revenue of this industry will in turn cause major ripple effects upon other industry. This affects the supply curve of the supply and demand function. Inputs are part of the supply of goods and services, so this will decrease, therefore driving the price of semiconductor chips up. Firms are paying more, and there is heightened costs that will not be made up by revenue, causing a lead to economic downturn. Semiconductor chips are present in almost all of our goods that we use regularly on a daily basis, so this shortage affects the entire world. Companies will have to make tough decisions on labor and allocation of funds due to the major losses they are undertaking. It will be fascinating to see how this economic disruption plays out and how firms will recover in the future. Presenting Technology Chatter of Hits and Misses with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. WeMax Projector.
Marty, how are things? What have you come across lately?
I would like to project some happiness.
Project some happiness, okay. Yes.
Let me start with this stick. One moment, please. What am I holding?
It looks to be like a square tube thing. Oh, wow. Okay. The silver screen. Oh, wow. I haven't seen one of those in years. Decades,
yes,
actually.
Yes, this is a desktop screen you can use. You know, if you collapse it like I've collapsed it back in, goes in like a window shade, you can use this to beat up people who are attacking you if you want to, because it's a metal bar.
Sure, yeah.
You put on a table.
Yeah.
And when you put it on a table, imagine the size of monitor you could give yourself if only you had a way to project onto it.
Yeah. Except that's that's silver screen. We haven't had those in ages. We've moved on to the white screens and then kinds of glass embedded and
blue screens, green screens, and
oh, there's that too. Yeah.
Yeah. And chicken screens and all that stuff. Look, a charger cord. I have a charger cord. What's at the other end of it? How big is it? You tell them.
So that looks to be about the size of one of the larger desktop hubs. So
an inch by 4 inches by 8 inches. A little longer than a paperback book, but pretty much the same thickness, right? And what's on the underside here? A little flap that comes up.
Okay.
People on the radio, I hope you're watching this. A little flap that comes up when I bend it out, which can change the height of the front if it's down like this.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, why would I do that? Let's have a close look at the front. Radio people, don't squint. when I open it up this way, I expose a projector lens.
Yeah.
And this little skinny thing is a 4K projector.
Wow, okay.
HDMI on the back. You want this for the office, or do you want this to watch Netflix with your pals? Because you don't have to have a permanent big screen hung on a wall. You don't have to have anything eating up your pool table. I know you've got billiards in the attic, right? And you don't. You're not taking – and this sit on a bookshelf. It fits a bookshelf when you're not using it.
Yeah,
remember
books,
anybody? Anybody remember books?
I have a number of books, but I'm a nerd like that, so hey.
Well, yeah, I know. The Idiot's Guide to What?
Oh, I've got a number of those. I've got a good portion of the entire series, but yes, go on.
All right. So there are projectors all over the place, but finding a portable 4K, and this one can be battery powered.
Mm-hmm,
it has no problem with that. You charge it. You want to have a drive-in movie in your backyard? Put it on the picnic table, and you got a drive-in movie in your backyard. You want to have fun? How flat's the hood on your car? Put the screen on the front of the hood of the car and put this in the windshield or just ahead of the windshield, and you can watch your movie from the car. I mean, it is so flexible, and it's 4K. You've seen that commercial where the guy says, robbers, thieves, they're making you pay money to watch 4K TV when you could be watching it with a 2-inch rabbit ears thingy. Yeah, well, except that it's usually not 4K if you're watching it over the air. Makes a big deal about being able to see it on a boat in the Gulf of Mexico. Look. If I'm on the Gulf of Mexico in a boat, watching TV is not why I'm there.
Go figure. Yeah.
So point is, this WeMax, WeMax, this WeMax projector, this little 4K projector, is one of the coolest examples of a portable big screen that isn't big until you need it to be a screen.
Very cool. What is the we're now in Lumen equivalence or whatever crazy thing. Any idea of the output?
No idea at all, except it's plenty bright. And I would not – I mean, you could watch it with the lights on. Mm-hmm. If you're in an office, you could make it your third screen or second screen or whatever.
Sure. Okay.
You're
all right. All right. So
it's enough for that if you're close.
Decent.
But
yeah.
If you're crossing a room, I'd make it dark, you know.
Mm-hmm. But I tend to do that anyway. So, okay. All right. Yeah. I get that.
Yeah. And look, it's small enough that you can put your bowl of popcorn right on top. And it
just be careful about, you know, spilling the hot butter into the mechanism or any of that.
Oh,
I might void the
thought.
Warranty.
Yeah, butter movies.
So what are we talking about for the price point on something like that?
I never ask.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
I get these things for review. You know,
yeah, okay, fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah, and Ben would next say, Marty, between segments, send me one. Have him send me one. Will you have him send me one?
I would never do that. Oh, wait. Yes, I would. I'm sitting here nodding, going, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, they can't see that on the radio, Ben.
No, they can't. So very cool. You know, this is something that, you know, we're really moving towards that home entertainment thing again. You know,
but beyond home, you know, the reason I'm fond of home entertainment is easy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But to be multi-purpose like this, to be able to make this a business computer additional screen when you really need something big. Anybody who works in CAD, wouldn't you love to have a much bigger screen to watch CAD on?
Yes.
Right? You put that file up, that step file, you want to see it in 3D. You need those details. You need to be able to read the numbers. A big screen makes all the difference. 4K on the screen makes it lovely. And when you're done, you take it home to watch Netflix.
Very cool.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a meeting on Thursday, January the 27th. Meeting start time is 6:45 p.m., and it's a virtual meeting via Zoom. Their website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC's Users Group meets Thursday, February the 4th. Their meeting time starts at 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, February the 5th. Meeting time starts at 8 p.m., online virtual meeting via Jitsi. The website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, February 10th. Meeting time is at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, February the 11th. Meeting start time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.